I think for me, you know, why I would think that putting my deepest fears in a song and singing it for strangers would be like a safe thing, but it sort of is what I do. I take things that I wouldn't tell my close friends and I put them in a song, and then I take them across the Southeast and get on little stages and sing them for people I don't know.
Yeah.
And but yeah, I don't know that I've met an artist that's not a bit of a worrier, and I don't know that I've met a songwriter who is not to some extent using that as a way to make sense of their own lives.
Welcome to Curious Goldfish, a podcast community where music and curiosity come together through interesting conversations with the music makers of our world. I'm your host, Jason English. You can find Curious Goldfish in all the major podcast and social media platforms. And of course, we have all of our content on our website, curiousgoldfish.com. I firmly hope not all nice guys have to finish last. And as someone who considers himself a nice guy, I am always pulling for any other man out there who is not just nice, but kind and authentic. One such person is singer-songwriter Mike Kennebrew. In this episode, which is part one of a two-part series with Mike, we explore the intricate connections between music, vulnerability, and personal growth. He shares his experiences of using songwriting as a cathartic process to navigate his deepest fears and life challenges, including his decision to quit drinking. The discussion sheds light on the impact of sobriety on his life, family, and creative process, offering insightful reflections on being present and making positive changes. You should check out Mike's Instagram account, where he shares reflections of daily words he was feeling when he quit drinking. They are great examples of a musician, husband, and father who is trying to help those who might be struggling with alcohol addiction, or even those who are just trying to take a break from drinking temporarily. Aside from that, Mike is a tremendous musician and songwriter, having shared the stage with familiar artists like Drew Holcomb, Joan Jett, and Howie Day. He closes this episode with a great song called What's Left of Me, a single he released 2 years ago. It's a song he wrote about 2 months after he quit drinking. And now Mike is on the precipice of being 900 days sober. Here's Mike Kennebrew of Macon, Georgia. Let's dive in. Mike, thanks so much for your time.
Thanks for having me, man. This is awesome.
So we're at Lake Sinclair, which is kind of an hour, I think, southeast of Atlanta, but it's an hour northwest, I think, north of Macon, where you live, right?
I'm so challenged, north, south, east, west. I know that it took me 50 minutes.
50 minutes. Okay.
50 minutes to get here.
As the crow flies.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thanks so much for coming up and chatting. How long have you been in Macon?
About 18 years.
Okay. But you grew up in Atlanta, right?
Yeah. I grew up like east of Atlanta, just east, about Rockdale County.
Okay.
And then my wife went to medical school at Mercer. And so we moved just for her to do medical school. And then we never left. So that was never part of the plan, we're there.
All right. So it's always been Georgia for you?
No. I was born in Florida.
Okay.
Yeah. My dad was a preacher and we moved. He was preaching at different churches. And so, I mean, the first 12 years of my life would have been Florida, Lynchburg, Virginia, Memphis, Tennessee, Buckeye, Arkansas, Leechville, Missouri. Another place in Missouri, then Jacksonville, Florida, and maybe leaving something out. But so yeah, different school every year, and then moved to Georgia right before high school, and then stayed.
All right.
So
was he doing like Big Tent revivals?
You would think that, or he was murdering people, and we were on the run. But no, he was just. I wanted to ask him later on, were you just bad at your job? Why were we having to move every year? But I think he was great. I don't know what was going on, but we were moving like every year. And then he became a professor at a seminary. And that sort of stopped the moving and we stayed put.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I grew up in Missouri.
Yeah.
You're the first person that's literally uttered the words Leechville, Missouri to me in probably 45 years.
So you've heard of that town before?
Yeah, I've heard of it. Yeah, yeah. I can't believe that.
Yeah. We were in the Boot Hill of Missouri. Yeah. Yeah.
So in Kennett, that's where Sheryl Crow's from.
I knew Kennett. Yeah. Kennett was one of the towns that we could drive to. You know?
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, you're right there. Like
Holcomb.
Yeah. It's Tennessee, Missouri, and Arkansas mm-hmm. kind of area, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow. Okay. Well, that's awesome. So, yeah, I've kind of picked up that the faith, right,
yeah.
is still part of your life.
Yeah.
I would imagine. I guess what kind of imprint did that make on you, either, you know, having your dad doing what he was doing or being around other people? You know, what was the imprint you think that left on your life?
I'd say moving around a lot, the church was always a part of our lives mm-hmm. and that culture, for better or for worse, because it's hard to even, you know, give a split on which was, how much of it was better and how much of it was worse, but that Christian culture was always a part of my life. So, I got to see a little bit about what I wanted to keep and what I wanted to let fall away. But just a simple faith and was something that's, you know, definitely been a part of my life, all of my life.
Yeah, that's great. We're going to get to, you know, the songs mm-hmm. and some things in more detail, but, you're an artist from what I can tell, listening to you since, you know, late last year, you're about all the feels.
Yeah.
I mean, is sentiment, is that your middle name?
It should be, man. I don't know that I like it, but it's, you know, if you're trying to just sort of be who you are, write what's inside of you, that's what seems to come out. You know, it's just not a lot of, this one's just fun.
Right.
You know, it's all going to try and hit you in the feels.
Cause and back to the faith thing,
mm-hmm.
cause you know, family, you've got songs that are sort of, I would call like lighthouse guideposts, mm-hmm. messages to your kids,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah.
Baby girl, where the big waves are,
mm-hmm.
are some examples of that.
Yeah.
You talk about in one song, I think First and Last, that's like, about your grandparents and mm-hmm. their love, right?
Yeah.
But I think all of that to me is, it was familiar to me because I grew up in the church too. It was those sentiments about family and kids and mm-hmm. grandparents. To me, that reminds me of like the community of the faith community, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
Would you agree with that?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. I think that it's all kind of, the architecture surrounding all of the family has always been, at least in my experience, the church has always been the framework yeah. that it existed in.
Yeah. But you're not, in your music, you're not like, it's not overt. It's not like Christian music. Right?
Yeah, no.
It's very subtle.
No, I literally shouted yesterday because there was Christian music on in the car and I was like, I hate this music. And and some of it is good. I don't hate all of it, but yeah, I don't write it. And I've had people ask me, recently someone asked me in an email, she said, you know, well, if you are a believer, a Christian, why do you not write Christian songs? And I didn't really have a great answer for that other than I just write what I write, you know. I try to write good songs, and I think, you know, as far as my faith framework is just, I believe that God made me, he made me good at certain things, and I try to do them the best that I can, and when I get an opportunity to talk about the reason or the why, then I do.
Right.
But not to try to be too preachy.
Right. Well, I think, yeah, again, my experience growing up in what I would call the buckle of the Bible Belt, which mm-hmm. is Central Missouri. I grew up in a lot of Christian music and, mm-hmm. You know, so, like you said, some of it's good, but looking back, my take kind of is there's a lot of folks that I think, unfortunately, just kind of trying to make a buck off Jesus a little mm-hmm. bit, right?
Yeah.
The lyrics pretty shallow, you know, steal some scriptures here and there, mm-hmm. and kind of say, you know, praise Jesus and mm-hmm. sell some records.
Mm-hmm.
But I think like how I would respond to that email, just hearing that, mm-hmm. I'd be like, well, isn't God about family and kids and
yeah.
lifelong love?
Yeah.
Like, don't you see him through those things?
Yeah.
So like, I am writing Christian music.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I totally agree. And I think that those songs, I love the audience that I have. I'm not just singing in churches.
Yeah.
I rarely sing in churches.
Yeah.
And so I want music that anyone can relate to. And I would say to that also, like, well, what am I singing or writing that is un-Christian or anti-Christian, yeah. you know?
No, it's that drives me crazy. 'Cause it's like, just because you have in your house Bible verses everywhere, it's almost like they're kind of trying to like overcompensate
mm-hmm.
maybe some other issues. And, you know, as long as you've got the bumper stickers and the signs and everything,
yeah.
then you're the right kind of Christian.
Right. Yeah. Right. Which is in experience, not proven to be true.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's, don't ever write like Christian music.
Yeah. I don't plan to. I mean, I wrote a song this year that kind of was the most overt.
Yeah.
But even in it, I mean, I say things that would never be on Christian radio, right. About, you know, just try to be honest and go, all right, the next lyric would say something that would keep this song off of Christian radio. And I go, well, I'm going to write it anyway, yeah. you know, because I just want to write what's true.
Yeah. No, that's good. So how soon in your life did you get involved in music?
I was in the ninth grade. We had just moved to Georgia, and I got actually sent off to church camp. I didn't want to go, but it was like, oh, you'll meet some people, you know? And so I go, and I don't know anyone, and everyone else is friends with each other. And during the free time, there was this guy that had like a guitar, and he would go out and sit under a tree and play the guitar, and all the girls would just like swarm him. And I'm just like loner guy who doesn't have any friends. And I'm thinking that could be me, you know? So I got home and I said, Dad, don't you play guitar? Don't you have a guitar? You got to teach me. So he showed me some chords, and about ninth grade, I started playing guitar. Didn't start singing until later. Didn't start writing until a good bit later.
Yeah.
And initially it was just learning other people's songs,
yeah.
and singing them, doing 4 hours in a bar, you know, for cover tunes.
Nice. Did you ever have a normal, quote unquote, normal job or career before music kind of became your thing?
Right. I mean, I worked normal jobs. Like I was a gymnastics coach.
You were a gymnastics coach?
Yeah, I don't do gymnastics. But I was, when I was in college, this guy put a bulletin up that said, you know, we're hiring guys that are good with kids, it pays well, and it was near my house, and it was Rockdale Gymnastics. And so I was like, I don't do gymnastics. He goes, that's okay. I mean, you just got to be good with little kids, because it's like 5-6-year-olds that you just got to say, jump in the middle of the trampoline, you know, and don't, only one at a time. And yeah, I'm not teaching
right.
high level gymnastics here. It was more like the very entry level. So yeah. But I loved it. I was Coach Mike.
No, I bet you were great.
But when I would say like, hey, the longer I did it, the more you got to teach them different stuff. So, you know, here we're doing this round off and you got to, you know, do this and do that. And they go, well, will you show me? That's when I go, it's not my job to show you. You just do what I tell you.
That's hilarious. It's kind of, I mean, again, the Ted Lasso thing, it's like Ted Lasso. He didn't even know anything about soccer.
Yeah, he's a football coach,
he's
right?
He's a football coach.
Yeah. So I didn't have that illustration to lean on back then. I wish I had. I could have been, I'm Ted Lasso.
When's the last time you used the term round off, by the way? It's been a while.
Yeah, it's definitely been about 20 years. That was about 20 years ago when I coached gymnastics. But yeah, but it was glorified daycare. They had real coaches coaching the real gymnastics, but for the first graders, You know, I could just keep them safe and keep them in a line and all that. It was fun though. I liked working with kids. That was, if I had not done music, I think I was going to be like an elementary school teacher. 'Cause it was the only thing I ever did besides music that when I was doing it, I wasn't thinking about playing music. When I was hanging out with the kids and making them laugh or entertaining them or whatever, I really enjoyed it.
That's awesome. Mm-hmm. So at what point did you say, okay, the music thing could be something that you could pursue?
It was always the minute I wasn't a sports guy. My dad wasn't really an athlete and didn't play any sports, so he didn't get me into sports. And I didn't make good grades. I didn't have any clear path forward. So as soon as I seemed to have an aptitude for music, I thought, well, let me see if I can do this. And so that was always the goal and the plan. Yeah. And anything I did between delivering pizzas for Papa John's or working at the gymnastics gym was always just something to kind of supplement until I could make a living playing music.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. At what point did you realize that you could make a living?
Pretty early on.
Yeah.
Yeah. Not a good living, but you could go and play. This is, you know, it was a lot easier to get paid to go sing for 4 hours in Buckhead of the Eagles and James Taylor and all that than it was to get anyone to pay you to sing your own songs.
True.
So as long as I had the kind of stamina to drive up there and play from 10 p.m. to 2 a.m. for, a couple hundred bucks, then I could make some money doing it. And then I would always have something at a church on Sundays because I could lead the music.
Yeah, that's true.
At a church. And that was, you know, it was a blessing for me to have a steady income from that. And I think it was hopefully a blessing for them too, to have somebody that wasn't just using them for a paycheck and was pretty decent at it to do it. So between the two, I've always been able to do it, to make money with music.
Back to the church camp. That's funny. 'Cause like those guys with the guitars, I mean, there's a lot of talented musicians in the church.
Mm-hmm.
So that's funny that's kind of the aha moment.
Yeah. Yeah. It was a totally shallow, totally, I just want girls to like me and they seem to like this guy. So
well, that's great. Yeah. So you're, tell us about your family. You've got a couple kids.
Yeah.
Married, right? How old are your kids now?
They're all my wife, has a birthday on, March 13th. Emma will be 14 on March 20th. Turner just turned 12 on February 28th. So it's like a 3 week span and everybody has a birthday.
You're busy.
Yeah. So they're 12 and 14 basically. Okay. He is 12 and she's 14.
Are they into music as well?
Yeah. Lindsay plays piano and I taught Lindsay guitar. She hasn't really taught them piano much, but I've taught them both guitar and they both seem to like it.
Yeah.
Turner, I would say that's probably his main thing, more than any other hobby. He likes to play guitar.
So if Turner was to say, listen, Dad, I want to be like a professional musician and artist today, would you be like hell no, or it's possible? I mean, you know, 'cause the industry's changed so much.
Yeah.
Like, is that a future that you'd be like, yeah, go for it? Or
it would just have to be, you know, how do you want to make a living doing this? Yeah. You know, are you going to be an insanely good guitar player? There's a lot of those, you know, and, not all of them can make a living doing it. Are you going to write songs? You're going to write songs that you sing, or you're going to write songs that other people sing. You try to sell them. So I think I would love to sit down, and if he said, I want to do this, I'd love to go, okay, well, let's talk about how. What does that look like? I certainly wouldn't be like, hell no. Because it has not, I know some friends who would be for their kids, but it has not been hard for me.
Yeah.
I haven't been hugely successful, but I've also never been the starving artist. I think largely in part early on, I always had a thing at a church, you know, to kind of help me. And then my wife is a physician. So, and I've always had some sort of
That's good.
Income, you know, it hasn't been a real rough starving artist thing for me that would make me jaded about it. And I haven't been successful enough to be jaded. I've just sort of had a very charmed experience with music.
No, it's been good. I mean, you've opened for a number of well-known artists.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And I'd imagine you've toured a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Is it mostly in the Southeast?
Mostly Southeast.
Yeah.
Actually, 30A has opened up some more things for me because of all the people that come from all over. So within a couple of days of that festival, I was booked in Dallas to do something in April. I was in Scotland last year for Fringe Festival, and I'm going back in June to play again, do three shows there with a friend. So, but most of it has been, you know, Florida, Tennessee, North Carolina, South Carolina, Georgia, Alabama.
No, that's neat.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I noticed, you know, you did a song with Ellie Holcomb, and, you know, Drew and Ellie are awesome. I've seen them twice actually in Atlanta, both years on Valentine's Day.
Yeah. Yeah. They do that kind of traditional. Yeah.
It seems like they're probably the coolest, chillest, happiest couple on stage. You know, you never know, but like, are they cool to hang out with?
I've hung out with Drew more than with Ellie. I wasn't even there when Ellie did that song on my record. She did it after I had already cut the vocals, and I was back in Georgia, and she went in and did it. But Ellie's one of the sweetest people. I mean, she is exactly what she portrays herself to be. Very sweet, very kind, very bubbly. She and Drew's personalities are vastly different. But Drew's a solid guy. He's a good guy. He's been a good friend to me over the years. Always, he's on a rocket ship. I mean, they're blowing up. Sometimes people like that don't take your calls anymore. He always responds and takes my calls, and he's a kind guy.
Yeah.
And, they're both very, very good people.
Yeah, it's like the word genuine comes to mind when I see them on stage. And again, you never know, but I'm glad you sort of reinforced that.
Yeah, I would say that. And I've known them since for about 15, 20 years. They haven't changed, even though they're doing a lot of big things now.
Yeah.
Very good people.
And then like back to the Christian music thing briefly, like Ellie Holcomb, some would consider, I think she's kind of done country, folk, Americana, and then a little bit of Christian, but she's one of the ones that's like, okay, like that's cool, you know?
Yeah.
Cause she's great and it's authentic and it's.
Yeah. And I think there's several like that, you know, the singer songwriters who venture into Christian music, they seem to still be creating, you know, unique, good art. And I would definitely put Ellie in with that. I mean, she's a true songwriter. Yeah. She's real, really popular in Christian music.
She is.
And then Drew is really popular in the Americana thing. And then they do their thing together. And it's a beautiful thing, you know? Yeah.
That's awesome. And then Matthew Perryman Jones,
right?
How long have you known him?
Longer than Drew and Ellie. Matthew and I met when he lived here in Atlanta. He moved to Nashville about a year after we became friends. And we went, we did some... He probably won't like this, but we did some church camps together. I brought him down to Panama City Beach to do like a music thing over a church camp with me. And that was when we were both just, I mean, probably 21 years old or something. And then he went out to Nashville and started writing songs a lot more and got a publishing deal. And again, he's had a lot of success. I respect him and look up to him as a writer as much as anybody.
Yeah.
And he's a great guy too.
Did you bring him to perform at the church camp?
So I was having to go, and I was like, man, come with me. Would you just come? And because when we're not, in Panama City, when we're not doing the music, we just hang out. And he came for some reason. He wanted to go deep sea fishing. He took me on my first deep sea fishing, it was miserable. I was throwing up for 5 hours, and we still talk about that. But he went down, and he kind of drew and Matthew and. And we all kind of were doing the church thing and the sing. If you were a guy writing songs, at that point in time, the church was a good place to sing them. If you were wholesome, you didn't even necessarily have to be overtly Christian. And so we were all doing some of that.
Yeah.
And then they kind of just went more Americana folk. Stuff.
Yeah, it makes sense.
And so did I.
Yeah.
But I think we all have a lot of people like that have their roots in that. Yeah. Ben Rector, Andrew Rip, a lot of those guys, you know, got their start in the church.
I think I met his music through, did you ever see Paste Magazine?
Yeah.
Yeah. So they, it's like, I wish I still had them. I actually regret it. I used to have every Paste sampler because they would send the magazine.
Oh, I forgot about that. Was Matthew on a Paste sampler?
Yeah.
Oh, cool.
And I forgot the song, but it probably would have been 2005, 2006, 2007, maybe.
Yeah.
I don't know. But it was the coolest thing because you get a CD inside the magazine, mm-hmm. and they'd load up the songs. It was almost like the 2000s version of a playlist.
Yeah.
You know, but it was on a disc. And, yeah, I remember because he is a unique name. He was like Matthew Perriman Jones. Okay, yeah. That's interesting.
Yeah.
Have you seen him lately?
Yeah, we had dinner last month, and that's when we bumped into what's his name at Jenny's Ice Cream, Theo Von.
Oh, Theo Von is the comedian, the podcaster.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah, but no, I saw him. So I've been going back and forth to Nashville recording this album for about 9 months, and Matthew and I have gotten dinner a few times. While I'm there, I have a few friends out there. It's such a great community. I love that my people are here in Georgia, but right. Man, so many great people that I love live in Nashville. And, so Matthew's on the top of the call list of people when I'm in town, I'd love to get dinner with. And I don't spend my life with people who are doing music. You know, right. I live in Macon, yeah. and I mostly just wake up feeling like a dad and a husband and a guy that works at his church and works with youth and stuff like that. And so it's great when I'm in Nashville to get together with someone like Matthew and talk about being a songwriter, being an artist and what his careers look like and what's coming up. It just something alive.
That's awesome.
Comes to life in me.
So are you guys just hanging out with Theo Von just randomly? Or?
Yeah. So we were talking about comedians. My friend Jody's an actor and he was in a movie with Tom Segura. Do you know who he is?
I know who he is.
So yeah, Tom's a comedian. And Jody was in this movie with Mark Wahlberg and Tom Segura. So he became buddies with Tom Segura, and Tom was playing at the Tabernacle and invited us to come. And so I went out and I was like, oh, this guy's great. So Tom is one of my favorite comedians. That's and awesome. We were talking about like, who's your favorite? And someone said like Chappelle. And then I was like, who is that guy that has the kind of the mullet, and he's kind of younger and got a real kind of interesting way of talking. And they said, my friend William said, that's Theo Von. And I was like, oh yeah, do you like him? And then Matthew goes, he's here. And I was like, hey, what do you mean here? Like he's here. Like I said, in this Jenny's Ice Cream. He was like, yeah, he is here right now. And we were all so, it was like we had summoned him by, I said, what's his name? William said, Theo Von, and Matthew said, he's here. And I was just thinking, man, we picked the wrong dude to summon. Like I would have said, let's talk about Bono or right. somebody like,
right.
but Theo Von was in, yeah. But Matthew and I had dinner.
That's
and fun. Then we bumped into Theo Von,
all right.
but didn't speak to him.
That's good.
But he about turned that Jenny's Ice Cream upside down. He came in with a girl and totally just sat down trying to have his ice cream, and by the time we got up to leave, we were walking out, and every Belmont student was in there with their phones and either recording him or on their phone going, he's here, I'm looking at him right now. So he
dang,
but they were leaving him alone, you know, apparently. Yeah, yeah. That's the Nashville code, is
yeah,
you don't good. Mess with him.
Oh,
that they moved to Nashville because yeah. they know people there will let them be.
Yeah. So you mentioned the community of, you know, you love Georgia, but
yeah.
it's Nashville. So Atlanta, obviously, in Georgia in general, Atlanta has a tremendous music scene.
Yeah.
Being in Macon, how do you find time and how do you make that work to like have those times where you connect with other artists? Because it is important.
Yeah. Right? I don't connect as much as I wish I did.
Yeah.
You know, this year I've done it more
yeah.
than ever before. Between going to Nashville and working on the record. So I'm around these musicians and I'm in town and have a chance to reach out and say, hey, can we get lunch? Can we get dinner? And so between that and then doing some of these festivals like 30A, where I bump into songwriters that I've kind of seen them around or I've talked to them through social media.
Right.
And now I'm with them. We're doing the same. We're in the same small town. And so I've been networking more or just building community more or trying to join the community that's already there more than I ever have before. I'm kind of introverted. I choose to not hang out with people, and but it's so valuable. It's been really good for me.
Yeah. I would imagine just the inspiration and the creativity just probably feeds off each other. You know,
yeah.
When you hang out with, you know, Elliot Bronson or
you
know, whoever might be there.
Well, it just helps me at least, you know, I don't know if any of them feel this way, but it helps me to feel like I said, I don't really feel like an artist most of the time when I wake up. I just feel like a 46-year-old man, you know, and getting to be around other artists helps me to kind of remember who I am and what the fabric is of me.
Yeah. 46-year-old former gymnastics coach.
Yeah, let's not forget it.
Don't forget that.
Yeah.
So what I want to do is shift a little bit. So again, I started following you late last year, and then in January you started doing something on Instagram, which I thought was pretty interesting. You talk about being vulnerable and empathetic. Just those are terms that we hear a lot about. But you went on Instagram and was like, listen, if you're trying out Dry January, I want to share some thoughts with you. I guess, could you give us kind of how you explained it online, and we can go through some examples. It was really pretty cool.
Yeah. Yeah. I didn't realize that it would be, I didn't know if anyone would care, listen. I didn't know if it would have a reaction or not. And, but yeah, January 1, we were in Highlands, North Carolina. And I just thought, you know what, I'm going to put this out there. So when I quit drinking about 2.5-3 years ago, I made a list every day, or I just made a little note every day in my notes app on my phone of something I noticed that day when I wasn't drinking, and something positive. Like, oh, well, this is different. You know, I never used to take any days off when I was drinking. I drank every day. Hmm. As soon as the work was done for the day, I would make a drink and drink, you know, quite a lot. After about 30 days of that, I quit making the list, but I held on to the note, and I thought, you know, that might be good for some other people that are doing it. And so it just occurred to me to put one out every day.
Yeah.
I'm just going to read what I wrote, and maybe it'll, you know, for those of you that are trying Dry January, maybe it'll help you to see something positive to get you through another day. You know, it's the why behind when you're doing something like that. You know, whether it's you're trying to diet, or you're trying to give up alcohol, or you're trying to do whatever, at some point in the day, you're like, why am I doing this? I'm an adult. This is America, damn it. Like, I can. Right. And so to have a why behind it and go, well, I'm doing it because this or that, you know, these good things are coming from it, and that's why I'm doing it. So.
No, it's really neat. So on Instagram, Mike Kinnebrew, you can look at, you know, looking up if you're listening, but you basically say sobriety is,
and then
it's like the theme of the day based on the note that you did 2.5 years ago.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, exactly.
So like like the first day you said, you know, sobriety is not dying from something stupid.
Yeah. I went kind of,
that's, you know, that's good.
Yeah. Some of them were silly. Like I think my sobriety is, I think my skin's looking better. And,
right.
But the first one was, you know, was not dying for something stupid.
Yeah.
Because, when I was drinking, I would get behind the wheel of a car. You know, you tell yourself you're okay. You tell yourself it's not very far to drive or whatever.
Yeah.
And so that one went pretty deep, and didn't stay that deep and heavy for the whole 30 days. But yeah, that was one of them, and it was a real one.
It's
and
real,
I don't
yeah.
I don't really know how else to be. You know.
Yeah.
Whether writing songs or talking on a podcast or putting those sobriety is things out there.
Yeah.
I'm maybe candid to a fault and vulnerable to a fault. And you just hope that by being that way, that it gives people permission to be that way in return, you know?
No, I think people appreciate it,
mm-hmm.
you know, especially if you're an artist, you know, people want to know, I think, the context of the heartbreak, the pain, the love that people are going through, even if, you know, even if they've never experienced it, they could probably, I think, somehow relate to it. And at some point in their lives, it'll be relevant to them. You know?
Yeah. Yeah, it's sort of, and I don't mean to say anything negative about people who don't write their own songs.
Yeah.
If you don't write your own songs, I'd love to sell you mine. But it's kind of a wet blanket on falling in love with a song and then realizing the person singing it really, you know, didn't write it, didn't have any real emotional, they could have a connection to it, but it's just sort of a little deflating feeling when you go, oh, they didn't even write that, you know? Right. And so whether I can relate to what that person is singing about or not, I can just, I believe them, you know? And it's like, they're telling me something. I always felt like music was, songs were telling me something.
Yeah.
And so the fact that the person lived through that, whether I could relate to it or not, meant it resonated with me.
Yeah. Yeah. So the, just to kind of wrap this up on the sobriety is thing. So, you know, not dying from something stupid was day one.
Yeah.
Day two was sobriety is reading with Turner.
Yeah.
Which is cool. Cause that obviously time with kids is special.
Yeah.
You know, every day that goes by, they're getting older. It's one day closer to when they're not at home. So the fact that you're sober, not drinking, I think those, I would imagine those times became even more special.
Yeah, I mean, there were, not to mention, I mean, there were times when I would go up there and read with him and just sort of zone out, zonk out. You read, you know, I'm there, but I'm not really there.
Yeah.
And then there were other times I just go, I'm going to go to bed early, you know. And so I think on day two, the reason I wrote that was just that I was up there and we were reading and I realized I was enjoying it. You know, I'm looking at him, I'm thinking about how he's getting better at reading and how he's getting older, and I'm wide awake and I'm in this moment and I'm thinking about all the other times that I passed up on being right there where I was, because when I'd start drinking, I'd just get tired, you know, and I just want to stay where I'm at. Don't want to go up the stairs and do that. And so, yeah, it was definitely, That was a real eye opener for me that I'm here and I probably wouldn't be here if I was drinking that day.
That's awesome. And day seven is just that sobriety is being 100% present.
Yeah.
In your life.
Yeah. Yeah. When I talk about how I quit, then no one ever said, oh, thank God you quit. You know, like we were all worried about you. Nobody really knew that the effect it was having on me, but I knew that because I would always show up. I showed up for everything. I didn't no show work or games or plays or anything, but I wasn't necessarily always there, you know. And so that was definitely day seven. It was not just being there, but being actually there.
Yeah. Well, I credit to you for doing that. You know, not a lot of 46-year-old former gymnastics coaches would pull that off. But
yeah. Well, I stuck it. I stuck the landing on that one.
That's awesome. Yeah, no, it's seriously, like, it, in all seriousness, it was just something, I'm like, okay, this guy is authentic and genuine, and it wasn't like you're looking for likes or fishing for, Mike, you're such, you know, praise Jesus, you're, you know, you know, God bless you, you know, you weren't, it was just like, hey guys, here's a couple things, if you're trying Dry January out, hopefully this will inspire you to think about, you know, getting through that, and maybe you'll make it a life change. You know, it was really, really cool.
Yeah. Sometimes that vulnerability, like you get hit by traffic going both ways, because the church, I think some of my more churchy friends were like, don't put it out there that you drank that much. Well, like it makes them a little nervous that I was being so honest about it. And then maybe some others were like, you know, are you trying to sound like drinking is bad? Are you trying to be judgmental to people who are drinking?
And, interesting.
And I go, no, I mean, not at all. Like, if you can drink and not be irresponsible and waste your life with it, then I miss it. I still miss it. I love drinking, but I just couldn't do it in a right way. But yeah, that being honest and doing it the way I did it and sharing it the way I shared it, hopefully it came through the right way. But I feel like, you know, at some point people on the extreme in either camp are like, we don't like you.
Yeah, that's disappointing, but I guess not surprising.
Yeah.
So I think right about that time when you decided to not drink anymore, I think you wrote a song called What's Left of Me.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah.
I guess
That was about a month or two in.
Was it? Okay. Mm-hmm. So it was kind of correlated.
Yeah.
Yeah. Tell us, because it's the, I think, one of your most recent singles.
Yeah.
Or maybe the most recent single.
Yeah. Second to, there's one that's newer, but yeah, it's the second to most recent.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's beautiful. I'm going to read some of the lyrics here in a second, but what was the inspiration for What's Left of Me?
Anytime I start writing, I don't quite know where it's going to go. And you start writing and it sort of reveals itself what the song is going to be about. And, but I was definitely every day waking up with the headline that I used to do this and now I'm not doing this and life is weird. You know, it's just weird that I used to drink and now I'm not drinking. What is going on? And how do I process this? And so, but I'm making a change at 44 years old. You start thinking about all the time that's passed. And as I put alcohol kind of in the rearview mirror, I'm looking back and I'm thinking about all the nights that I didn't go up and read with Turner, or all the things I wasn't really present for. And you just start to, it's easy to get in this loop of beating yourself up over the time that you've lost, maybe going in the wrong direction or wasted. And so the kind of the theme to that song is just, could I take what's left of my life and say, okay, well, if there's some kind of plan, I will surrender and you can have what's left of me. And, let's see if we can do something great with that, you know? And I believe that we can.
No, that's incredible. I love that. And I think each verse, I could be wrong, but it feels like you're talking to Lindsay in one verse, or maybe a family member. And then kind of the last verse, it feels like you're talking to God.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. The last verse is definitely, sort of a faith, like a repentance and altar moment,
baptism in the river.
Exactly. Yeah. Like a salvation, kind of moment. The verse about with Lindsay is that she, you know, I guess I'm drinking more than most, at least that's what she told me. And she really was the only one who said, you know, hey, how many is that? You know?
Right.
But yeah, and the first verse takes on worry and anxiety, because I would say I spent a lot of my life worrying. Mm-hmm. I'm a big time worry guy. And then the second verse takes on drinking. And the two big things that were big kind of life wasters for me was worrying and then maybe abusing alcohol.
Yeah. Well, the first verse I wrote it down. Mm-hmm. Hopefully I got this right. Lord, have mercy on a troubled heart like mine, who could probably do some good if he wasn't worried all the time.
Yeah.
And if there's still some kind of plan for what my life can be, I'll lay down and you can have what's left of me.
Yeah.
That's killer.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, that's really killer. The worry aspect of it, mm-hmm. is, do you think a lot of artists are anxious and worried and they do they use the art and they do they use the time and in front of people to sort of like work through that
therapy?
Yeah.
I think for me, you know, why I would think that putting my deepest fears in a song and singing it for strangers would be like a safe thing, but it sort of is what I do. I take things that I wouldn't tell my close friends and I put them in a song. And then I take them across the Southeast and get on little stages and sing them for people I don't know.
Yeah.
And, I don't know that I've met an artist that's not a bit of a worrier. And I don't know that I've met a songwriter who is not to some extent using that as a way to make sense of their own lives.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
That I've heard more times than I can count. They say it's, you know, cheaper than therapy.
Yeah. Well, appreciate your time. Could you play us some music?
So. All right, so this is What's Left of Me. My way into a million nights and
voices in my mind tell me it's all real. Buckle up and settle in if you ask me how I feel. So Lord have mercy on a troubled heart like mine. He'd probably do some good if he wasn't worried all the time. And if there's still some kind of plan what my life can be, I'll lay it down. You can have what's left of me. I guess I'm drinking more than most, at least that's what she told me. I started reaching for it anytime I was anxious or lonely. These days that's all I feel unless I've got one in my hands. When it's coursing through my veins it makes me less than what I am. So Lord have mercy on an addicted heart like mine. He'd probably do some good if he wasn't drinking all the time. And if there's still some kind of plan what my life can be, I'll lay it down. You can have what's left of me. I never meant to drag around these demons for so long. I guess I always thought I'd change it again. 20 years of trying to light the darkness on my own. Just let guess you've got more grace than most, at least that's what I'm told. You're bringing beauty from the ashes, take the broken, make them whole. If lost is what you're looking for, I swear I fit the bill. Though I ain't got much to offer you, just an emptiness to fill. So Lord have mercy on tired heart like mine. We never meant to be this way, it just happened over time. So let me dive into the river, let the water wash me clean, and I'm coming out so you can have what's left of me. Oh, I'm coming out and you can have what's left of me.
Thanks so much for joining us for another episode of Curious Goldfish. Please follow and subscribe to the podcast and on social media. Also, tell your music-loving friends about us too. Until next time, stay curious.